Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan in South Sudan this Thursday, March 7, 2024. Some families in the South Sudan's capital, Juba, say they have to cut down the number of meals per day due to soaring prices of food in the market.
No, the list today, I had to prioritize some of the items that I really need at the moment because of the prices. I could not manage to buy everything that I wanted. There's something that you prioritize. There's something that you can just leave. Yeah, you cannot buy everything at once. Yeah, because the prices keep shooting up every now and then.
And an American analyst says the charges pressed against Peter Biera Jack and Abraham Cholkage are very serious.
Especially when you look at the allegation that they were attempting to buy automatic weapons, grenade launchers, and missile systems. And so it's not just kind of exporting kind of routine public, you know, weapons for kind of the public. These were military-grade weapons, and that kind of really increases the significance of this.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some residents of Juba Town say they must cut the number of meals they eat per day in order to survive the high inflation in South Sudan. One woman says her family can only afford to eat one meal per day. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
Adut Majur is shopping at Juba's Konyukonyu market to buy food for her family. She says she can only afford to buy a few items these days due to soaring price hikes at the market.
No, the list today, I had to prioritize some of the items that I really need at the moment because of the prices. I could not manage to buy everything that I wanted. There's something that you prioritize. There's something that you can just leave. Yeah, you cannot buy everything at once. Yeah, because the prices keep shooting up every now and then. Yeah. And that kind of, you know, the market is not stabilized. I actually prioritize maize flour. I prioritize oil. I also prioritize sugar.
The South Sudanese pounds depreciated again against the U.S. dollar in the past few weeks, causing some food prices to double at markets across the country. Some people in Juba Town say their lifestyle has changed in recent months for many reasons, including the country's economic crisis. Juba resident Fatma Charlie says some South Sudanese like her have to resort to cutting down the number of meals they serve their family per day.
Before, we were eating lunch and supper in the evening and then sleep. But now we are only taking porridge during lunchtime and only have one main meal in the evening, and then we sleep only for us to survive and continue to live.
Some civil servants in Juba say they have not received their salaries for the past 5 months. Flora Achola, a grade 7 civil servant with the Central Equatoria State Government, says she and other government workers struggle to put food on the table for their families.
We are in a very difficult situation because prices in the market have really gone beyond. We are only alive because of the power of God. We are staying without salary. When salary comes, at least you can buy some food items. But now there is no money, and we depend on God and only one meal a day. What is important for us now is tea in the morning.
Adut, Charles, and Ashola are all calling on national government officials to control skyrocketing food prices to ease the burden on families already struggling with other economic hardships. South Sudan Economic Cluster met last week to discuss avenues for increasing non-oil revenue collection and to expand supplies of subsidized food items at affordable prices at local markets across the country. President Salva Kiir, who chaired the meeting, assigned the members of the committee to supply fuel across the country, allocate funds to support agricultural projects, and auction the U.S. dollar to stabilize the exchange rate in the market's place. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
From Juba, we move back to the United States, where the two South Sudanese nationals, Peter Bier Ajak and Abraham Chol Kech, who were arrested this week on charges of conspiracy to illegally export weapons from the U.S. to South Sudan, are set to appear in a federal court in Phoenix, Arizona, on Friday. Declan Galvin, a geopolitical risk and security analyst, discusses with VOA's Nabil Biagio how Americans have reacted to the news of the duo's arrest and the serious charges against them.
The initial reaction to Peter Ajak's arrest, I think, will have caught many people in the United States by surprise because of his presence and kind of leadership and scholarship at a number of really notable universities, including Harvard. He's been featured on the website of kind of the African Leadership Institute, as well as the Africa Center. And so that I think is the first takeaway, that this is not just a random individual who was in exile in the United States. This is somebody who was really integrated within kind of the broader African policy community.
Peter Bier Ajak and his associate Abraham Chol Kej are facing charges of violating the Arms Export Control Act here in the U.S., as well as the Export Control Reform Act, and another charge about smuggling goods from the U.S. As far as security risks and laws and policies around them, how serious of a charge this is?
So this would be a very serious charge, in the United States. And, you know, it carries a prison sentence of, you know, depending on the charge, at least 10 years. And it's something that the U.S. kind of considers serious, especially when you look at the allegation that they were attempting to buy automatic weapons, grenade launchers, and missile systems. And so it's not just kind of exporting kind of routine public, you know, weapons for kind of the public. These were military-grade weapons, and that kind of really increases the significance of this. I'm monitoring for more charges or allegations that these two individuals violated what we call in the U.S. called the Neutrality Act. And the Neutrality Act basically says that it's unlawful for American citizens to take up arms against or plot against a nation which is at peace with the United States. Now, I don't recall the citizenship status of Peter Bier and if he is an American or not. But we had a similar issue in 2015 with two dual nationals who were Gambian and American, and they had plotted to overthrow the tyrannical regime of Yahya Jammeh in Gambia, and they were unsuccessful, and ultimately they were charged and incarcerated for violating the Neutrality Act. So I'll be very interested to see if this ends up applying to these two individuals or not, and that would just give us a broader understanding of kind of what Peter's intent was in purchasing and trafficking these weapons illicitly into South Sudan.
And you live in Nairobi, Kenya, currently, and you work there just next door to South Sudan. And if this operation was to be successful, it would have added a lot of volatility to an already fragile country like South Sudan in a troubled region. That region. Do you have any words about the implications for South Sudan and the region?
The presence of Stinger missiles, which is part of the allegation that they were attempting to purchase, particularly $4 million worth of military-grade weapons, that's definitely significant, and that would certainly create, more instability in South Sudan. What I think is fortunate is, based off of kind of the initial statements from the Department of Justice, it doesn't appear that these two individuals, you know, Peter Bier in particular, were anywhere near, you know, reaching the point where they're actually able to kind of break the arms embargo and export those weapons. It appears, you know, again, from Department of Justice statements, that the people they were attempting to purchase these weapons from were undercover law enforcement agents. And so they were very much wrapped up in a sting. And, you know, once the requisite evidence that would allow them to be prosecuted was collected, it appears that they were arrested and you know, the complaints were made. So as much as if this were to hypothetically go through, as much as that would be an issue, it doesn't appear that this ever, you know, neared reality for South Sudan or for the region.
That's Declan Galvin, geopolitical and security analyst based in Nairobi. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio yesterday. A senior diplomat at South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Juba says about 1,200 of the country's nationals are in prison across the United States. The diplomat said most of the South Sudanese who are serving prison terms are teenagers who did not formalize their legal status in the United States when their parents sought asylum. Two South Sudanese nationals, Peter Bier Ajak and Abraham Chol Kech, who were arrested this week in Arizona for allegedly planning to smuggle weapons into South Sudan, are scheduled to appear in a federal court on Friday in Phoenix, Arizona. Britain has circulated a draft resolution calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities in Sudan ahead of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which begins soon. The Associated Press says the draft expresses grave concern over the spreading violence and the worsening humanitarian situation. With Ramadan expected to begin around Sunday, the council is expected to vote quickly on the resolution, likely on Friday. According to UN World Food Programme, 18 million people across Sudan are facing acute hunger.
I call on all parties in Sudan to honor the values of Ramadan by honoring a Ramadan cessation of hostilities. This cessation of hostilities must lead to a definitive silence of the guns across the country and set out a firm path towards lasting peace for the Sudanese people. The values of Ramadan must prevail.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking at a UN Security Council meeting on Sudan this past hour in New York. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, China's top diplomat on Thursday rebuked the United States. Find out why after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. China's top diplomat on Thursday rebuked the United States and touted his country's closer ties with Russia. The comments came on the sidelines of a meeting on China's parliament. For more, VOA's Bill Gallo, who is in the Chinese capital.
China's foreign minister escalated his country's verbal attacks on the United States at a news conference in Beijing Thursday. Wang said, "Where is the credibility of a great power if the United States always says one thing and does another? Where is the confidence of a great power if it becomes tense and anxious at the mere mention of China?" That tone was a contrast from September, when U.S. President Joe Biden met Chinese President Xi Jinping in California. That meeting helped stabilize U.S.-China ties. On Thursday, Wang Yi accused Washington of not honoring its promises and said the United States is trying to contain China through sanctions. Wang said the desire to heap blame on China under any pretext has reached an unbelievable level. Even as high-level talks resumed, the United States has expanded sanctions against China on a range of issues, from human rights abuses to its relations with Russia. At his news conference, Wang defended China's support for Russia, even amid Moscow's war in Ukraine. He also kept up pressure on Taiwan ahead of the inauguration of a president Beijing views as a separatist. And amid an increasingly tense territorial dispute with the Philippines in the South China Sea, Wang vowed to respond to what he called provocations and interference by outside forces. The comments came as China holds an annual meeting of its rubber-stamp parliament under tight security in Beijing. The meeting aims to present a positive spin on the many problems facing China's economy. Many analysts see Wang's comments as a way to set the tone for China's foreign policy for this year. If so, there may be no shortage of problems for China to navigate. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Beijing.
The fall of a stronghold Ukrainians have been defending for almost 10 years is bringing the war closer to thousands of civilians in that part of Donbass area of eastern Ukraine. Many are fleeing west, but some are choosing to stay behind. Jan Boschat has their story from eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region.
Ukrainian police officers are trying to convince these families it's time to go. The sounds of explosions can be heard loud and clear from here. It's a constant reminder that we are not far from the front lines in this village of eastern Ukraine's Donbas region. A Ukrainian soldier speaking in Russian, as is common in this part of Ukraine, tries to persuade a villager to evacuate. He says, "Let's go while we're here. Come on." The woman replies, "She's not going." She has not decided yet whether she will go and says, "We'll call the soldiers when she makes up her mind." Inside the house, the woman's mother, 73 years old Paraskovia, who withheld her surname, enjoys a rare sunny day in this cloudy, cold winter to fix a jacket. She says the last weeks were loud, with artillery explosions happening all the time. The situation, you know, always this loud rumbling, it scares me a bit. It's scary. Despite the risks, Paraskovia's family decided to stay. They say they don't have anywhere to go. After almost 10 years of battles in this region of Donbas, the front line has appeared to be coming closer since the fall of Avdiivka, a stronghold Ukrainians lost in February. Since then, Russian troops have been advancing in this area, slowly but steadily. Russian troops are less than 5 kilometers from Ocheretino, but the town is already destroyed. This train departs every day from Pokrovsk, the biggest city in this region, not far from here. It takes away those who believe that the war is getting too close to them. 64-year-old Katerina Kirillovna is faced with the tough decision. The war is coming. We can hear it. We see on TV. Pokrovsk is being bombed. Katerina lives in one of the villages west of Avdiivka that is still under Ukrainian control. She's sending her granddaughter to a safe place far from the front lines. Tanya is just 15. But Katerina, like many civilians in this war, says she prefers to face the battles rather than become a refugee. At the train station, many soldiers who fought in the bloody battle of Avdiivka are finally going home to rest. One of them is Monia, who says his heart stayed behind in Avdiivka. And all he can say is he did it for them, the people of the city. In the last 2 years, Monia has left the front lines only twice. During the chaotic retreat from Avdiivka, he met Tanya and her grandmother. They stayed together in the last days, and now he's responsible for taking the young girl to her mother in central Ukraine. But in his eyes, it's easy to see that he's also taking back home the horrors of a brutal war that seems far from ending. Yabuesha, VOA News, Pokrovsk, Ukraine.
Russia's influence in Africa is expanding on many levels. Diplomatically, experts say Russia's goal is to gain more support for its vision of a multipolar world order based on weakened Western influence. At the United Nations, it lobbies African allies for favorable votes on issues like Ukraine conflict and works to sow distrust with UN peacekeeping missions and other multilateral efforts. David D. Roach, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi what the U.S. should do to confront these Russian goals.
What Russia seeks to do is their vision is they want to have a world where there are spheres of influence. So they recognize that the Western Hemisphere is mostly an American sphere of influence. They're perfectly happy with East Asia being a Chinese-dominated sphere of influence. And they feel that the Eurasia continent, to include everything that was part of the former Soviet Union and Soviet Pact, is a Russian sphere of influence. So they want to reestablish that sort of along Cold War lines. And they view Africa as the only place that's really kind of up for grabs. So they see themselves as being able to leverage first off their veto in the UN and then providing working with African countries, most of which have serious issues with corruption. They're able to use levers that are not available to politicians in true, open, accountable democracies in order to leverage these international institutions. The benefit of this from a Russian perspective is that people in the West and indeed around the world tend to view these multinational institutions as more virtuous than national institutions. So this is a way to enhance Russian prestige. The U.S. And the other democracies are at a disadvantage because, quite frankly, we can't give these countries stuff. And more importantly, we can't give corrupt leaders of many of these countries stuff the way the Russians can. We can't do it on the time scale. We can't do it in many instances just because what the leaders want is illegal, but the Russians can. So this is going to require a sustained involvement. And quite frankly, the Western engagement with Africa has been intermittent. I think we need to think about that and have a sustained presence on our terms, not just building whatever the ruler of the day wants, but it really does require a commitment to African development, and that has not been sustained or long-term.
In what's considered by many experts an existential challenge to Africa, Russian disinformation operations across West Africa have led to an unprecedented rise in popular support for Russia, citizen demands for Russian interventions, and in some cases, new military partnerships between African countries and Russia. What's your take on that?
This again requires us to have people more involved in the media, people, who call it out from the start. I mean, look, Russian disinformation in Africa has been going on for three generations. And there are a lot of things that Russia, has put out there. They have an established playbook. They have a global footprint. So, they'll get something published in an Indian newspaper and then trot that around, different African countries. And a lot of these things are persistent, like AIDS was invented in a laboratory in the United States, or allegations of organ harvesting of orphans, things like this. We have kind of seeded. We don't really have people who push back aggressively against this, because we tend to regard these things as ridiculous, or we just have an almost naive confidence that truth will eventually out itself. But what we really need to do is revitalize an agency we used to have, the U.S. Information Services, and consciously recognize that we're in a conflict here for influence, that the intellectual sphere is a domain of global power competition, and that we've kind of left it unaddressed. I don't know if that will happen, though, in the short term, given that we're obsessed with other more near-term issues.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University here in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. U.S. President Joe Biden will deliver his election year State of Union address Thursday, when he is expected to discuss his handling of the economy, reproductive rights, immigration, and the and the Ukraine and Gaza conflicts, but the 81-year-old will also use the occasion to demonstrate he is physically and mentally fit for a second term. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
This election year State of the Union address gives President Joe Biden a one-hour spotlight for his re-election bid, letting him tout his work on issues voters care about, like the economy, immigration, reproductive rights, and aid to Ukraine and Israel, and, hovering over it all, the alternative if he loses. It's a tall order for any president, but Biden also faces opposition over something he cannot change.
The American public remains concerned about Biden's age, and that is, I think, a key challenge he will have to get past while making the case for his re-election.
The White House told VOA the president will focus on issues.
He's very much looking forward to the opportunity to talk to the American people, to the Congress, and actually, quite frankly, the world, about all the incredible things that he has accomplished in these 3.5 years as president of the United States, from the economy to education to health care to employment, as well as on the world stage, and really restoring American leadership on the world stage.
Presidential analysts say Biden's words will center on policy, but the sizzle will come from his delivery and audience interactions.
I think he relishes being in the well of the House and mixing it up with members of Congress. The highlight of his State of the Union experience has been the moments when Republicans have rudely challenged him during his speech, even heckling him. And he's responded with alacrity, humor, and irony, and quite a lot of efficacy.
Foreign policy analysts expect Biden to highlight the conflict in Gaza, noting that he's invited relatives of Americans taken hostage by Hamas to attend the speech.
Previous State of the Unions have tilted a little bit more towards domestic issues. Of course, there's a domestic component to the foreign policy situation, particularly with the conflict in the Middle East. But this is definitely going to take up a lot of President Biden's focus, because that's what's on people's minds as well.
Pollsters say another man is on voters' minds as well.
For Biden, then, the key thing is showing that he can win the election against Trump. That's really the key thing he's going to have to show, even more than any sort of is he doing a good job with the economy or immigration or any of these other issues.
Biden gets his chance to answer that Thursday night. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday, March 7, 2024. We now leave you with the song Children of the Soil by the Rhymers. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
We are the children of the soil. We are fighting for equality, fraternity, and liberty. In all that you repair the damages, damages. We are the children of the soil.
I taught me fought like a team. We civilians get the support. No peace lives without water. Civilians are like a water body. A nation to develop, not a single fashion, tribe, or region for paternity. We need to struggle as a team. People remember we suffered. Unite to heal their wounds. In order to repair the damages.
We are fighting for equality, fraternity, and liberty. In all that you repair the damages. We are the children of the soil. We are fighting for equality, fraternity, and liberty. In all that you repair the damages. We are the children of the soil.
When we remember the religious leaders, the elders, the soldiers, and when we remember the women, the children, the youth, we